Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Infectious Diseases. This podcast aims to bring you expert perspectives from a multidisciplinary team on the pathway to diagnosis for patients with non-cystic fibrosis bronchiectasis. Specialists in the multidisciplinary team involved in caring for patients with non-cystic fibrosis bronchiectasis, along with the patient, share their perspectives on the pathophysiology and comorbidities of non-cystic fibrosis bronchiectasis, appraise the clinical presentations of the condition, and review the key diagnostic tools. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an educational grant from InSmed. In this podcast, a pulmonologist, a primary care physician, and a patient with non-cystic fibrosis bronchiectasis explore the key signs and symptoms of the condition and the journey to diagnosis.
Hello, my name is Professor James Chalmers, and I'm a consultant respiratory physician at the School of Medicine, University of Dundee in Scotland. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Professor Barbara Yawn, who's from the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, USA. And I'm also thrilled to be joined by Marta Almagro, a person living with bronchiectasis. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
In this section, we're going to cover the clinical presentation of non-CF bronchiectasis. So, Marta, let's start with the symptoms. So on a daily basis at the moment, how does bronchiectasis affect you in terms of your symptoms?
So I had my bronchiectasis since I was a child, and it wasn't until I got my colonization by Pseudomonas that my symptoms have been worse. My sputum is always kind of yellow greenish. I have a lot of cough. I have frequent voiceless episodes, and also with my sinusitis, it's all a bit complex.
Yeah. And how do things change when you get a chest infection? Because I guess exacerbations are the other part of the disease that we're talking about today.
Yeah. Well, that has also evolved during the years, because when you are young, you manage yourself in another way, and also your body responds in another way to antibiotics and also to the infection itself. But now it's more difficult for antibiotics to get me better. And also my chest congestion, it's worsened with the time. So maybe now I'm not just with purulent mucus, but with a very tight chest. And then after 3 days, then my sputum comes really green, and it a lot of quantity. So it varies.
Yeah. So Barbara, thinking about the patients that you see, you know, Marta's story must ring a few bells in terms of familiarity of the symptoms of bronchiectasis.
We see young patients and they have recurrent infections, and right away you think, oh yeah, that's because I missed their asthma. But we are talking with Marta, and your symptoms are not just a little bit of an exacerbation. You're talking about severe lower respiratory tract infections and lots of sputum. And I don't see that in young children very often. So that was really important for you to remind all of us. When we see a young person, 2, 3, 4, 10, 12 years of age, and they're having all of this cough and sputum, and you look in the medical record and you see, oh my goodness, they've been to the emergency room or even the hospital, I better start thinking of not just asthma, but beyond asthma to bronchiectasis.
Yeah. Would you say that Marta's presentation, what she's described, is quite typical? And is there any other features that you would tell our audience to look out for?
Well, you know, quite typical is obviously difficult when you're a primary care physician, because I don't see many young people with bronchiectasis. I don't know what else I should look for. What would you suggest, James?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the description of cough, sputum production, chest infections that don't settle or partially settle with antibiotics are quite important. Other things like breathlessness, which we might ask Marta about in a moment, and coughing up blood is the other thing that, you know, patients who cough up blood should immediately be an alarm bell that this needs further investigation. Are there any other symptoms, Marta, that you think that we should be telling people to look out for?
Yes, as you said, breathlessness. I wasn't told about the possibility of coughing blood. So it's not an issue for me because maybe I had 4 or 5 episodes in my life. But yes, it's something that it shocks you when you cough blood and you know that you don't have anything like, I don't know, tuberculosis or something like that. And other symptoms that you have to be looking for. I mean, I had sinusitis since I was born too. And sinusitis sometimes is related to primary ciliary dyskinesia, which I have. And in my case, it's the etiology of my bronchiectasis. So there are hints here and there that you may want to look for.
Marta, I was going to ask you about weather changes. I mean, as we go from a very hot summer to a very cold winter, are these problematic for you?
Always, and more with the age. It's not the same when you are, as I said before, you are a young person and you're healthy and your system is more efficient and reliable. And it's not only that you don't manage it well with the years, but it's also that the changes in the climate are more extreme. And also, it's really important to think about the pollution, because I live in Barcelona, and when there is a lot of pollution, I also have to keep me indoors the most of the time, because otherwise I get an exacerbation.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit now about the pathway to diagnosis, because that's, I think, really important. For you, Marta, how easy was it or how long was the journey to get a diagnosis of bronchiectasis?
13 years of,
wow,
of my life to get to a diagnosis. So I was born with colds, and I mean, since 2 months that I was born, my mom always tell me that I had colds, a lot of cough, sinusitis, recurrent bronchitis, and I had an adenectomy when I was 2 years old. My pediatrician didn't know really well what was happening to me, so they refer to my parents to another pediatrician pulmonologist, and she knew something more about it, but there was not an easy question and not an easy answer. So they referred me again to a hospital clinic in Barcelona that at the time were treating children, and they had a really pioneer respiratory pediatrician team. They knew something that was going on. They did to me saccharine test to see if there were involved my cilia. They also put me to a lot of radio diagnosis, like simple Rex, but also another nuclear diagnosis imaging that went on during the years, But in the meantime, I got two pneumonias. And I think it was the second one that then I got a chest infection so bad that it got me love medium syndrome. So I had to underwent surgery to remove it. In the biopsy, they write down that in my way compatible with bronchiectasis, but it wasn't until I was 13 years old when I was finally diagnosed with primary ciliary dyskinesia through bronchoscopy and also of bronchiectasis through a CT scan. So it was a long journey with a lot of tests of all kinds.
This had to be so frustrating for your parents, not just you being ill, but your parents. They keep bringing you in, and we as the healthcare community, yeah, sort of treat the little problem here and then you go away and we may forget about it. So when an example of really listening to the parents and understanding their frustration. And when somebody has this level of frustration, that's one of my first warning signs of I need help. It's not just the patient needs help. I, as a physician, need help. James, this is when I'm going to send somebody, I hope, to you and say, help.
Yeah, so I mean, Marta's, I think, really powerfully describes the impact of delayed diagnosis there. But delayed diagnosis isn't just limited to children. I mean, in studies of adults, the majority experience symptoms for more than 10 years before they get a diagnosis of bronchiectasis. So this is across the spectrum of bronchiectasis. So we need to think about how we increase the diagnostic rate, increase the awareness. And that means it's you and me, Barbara, it's thinking how between primary and secondary care we can join up that diagnosis and try and make the pathway easier. Because I think Marta's powerfully told us the impact of when we don't get that right. So can you think of, as the final word, Barbara, do you think there's any key messages we can give in terms of improving the diagnosis of bronchiectasis?
Well, I think the recurrent nature of the symptoms is really, really important. I mean, these are recurrent episodes of infection, of cough, of sputum that are way outside the normal of what kids or adolescents or adults or older adults get. This is the time to say, I'm suspicious something else is going on. Let me ask someone else to help me and make the patient a partner in this. Make sure I understand the impact on them. So ask, listen, and be suspicious. Ask for help.
Yeah, and that's a great message to finish with. So thank you to Barbara and Marta for this really fascinating and important discussion around the symptoms and diagnosis of bronchiectasis. And I hope you can join us for some of the other episodes in this series.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic on Touch Infectious Diseases at www.touchinfectiousdiseases.com. Don't forget, there are two other chapters in this series, so please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team.